Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And New York Times columnist David Brooks is with us now to talk about his new book, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. Hi, David. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you as always.
By social animal, do you mostly mean that we are products of our cultures?
Well, that's part of it. This book started because I was doing research into why so many kids are dropping out of high school, which is a completely irrational decision. And I learned that a lot of the stuff that influences that happens in the first 3 years of life, that if you look at the way a kid attaches to mom or dad at 18 months, you can predict with 77% accuracy who's going to graduate from high school. And so that took me into the field of brain research. And really, it's just this revolution in how we're understanding ourselves. So I wanted to take the research from a bunch of different spheres and combine it really into one story just to bring everybody up to speed on what's going on and really draw out a few implications of what it means for the rest of us.
Just to digress for a moment, if dropping out of high school is determined in the first 3 years of life, is all this running around demanding a longer school day and less teacher tenure, and no matter which politics you're coming at all of that from, beside the point?
No, it's not determined in the first few, but it's influenced. And so one of the things we're comfortable talking about, and I've been covering education for all this time, is we're comfortable talking about moving the bureaucratic boxes, the length of the school day, big classes, small classes. But the elemental truth is that people learn from people they love. And what really matters is the relationship between the teacher and the student. And any reform that skirts that core issue is not going to be that effective. And that's the larger truth of the book, whether it's education or politics or business, that we're really good at talking about bureaucratic boxes, economic incentives, things we can count and measure. We're pretty bad at talking about emotions and relationships. And so one of the things the research is doing is giving us a way to talk about relationships, a way to talk about emotions, and to show that emotions aren't soft, squishy things that are irrelevant to world success, but they're actually the hard things, the really practical things.
And one way that you tell the story in the book is through the lives of a fictitious but very recognizable couple, Harold and Erica, from infancy through old age. Who are Harold and Erica?
Well, Harold's a middle-class suburban kid who maybe starts out charming and a little shallow, and over the course of his life learns to develop some of the deeper currents within himself. Erica's a young woman, she starts out as a girl who's from an underprivileged background. Her single mom is from Chinese-American, her dad is Mexican-American, and they have periods of real depression. And she sort of claws her way up, in part by going to a charter school and learning some of the skills you need beneath the academic school skills. And I use them really just to illustrate the research. I wanted to do it in a way that showed how the research played out in concrete situations. I wanted to do it in a way that hopefully is fun. And I wanted, one of the elements of the research is that we're not only rational creatures, we're emotional creatures. And I wanted the story to reflect both ways we perceive the world.
So let me give you carte blanche, David, and invite you to tell any one story from Harold's or Erica's life and how a bit of brain research plays into it.
Well, let's take Erica is a young girl. Her mom's manically depressed, Erica has to check her into a hospital. And Erica senses her own life spinning out of control, but she has the key insight, which is that we don't have the ability to really change our own minds by ourselves, but we can choose an environment. And once you get in the right environment, that's going to change your mind. So she more or less forces herself into this charter school, which is modeled after a KIPP school. And she goes up to the board of directors in the middle of one of their meetings and just barges in and demands to be let in. And they said, well, we have a lottery. You just apply for the lottery. And she refuses to accept that. She says, let me in. And they try to throw her out of the room. And there happens to be a guy in the room who is a hedge fund manager who happens to fund the school. And he passes a note to the principals. And it says, in effect, rig the friggin' lottery. And she forces herself in by just sheer determination. And the elemental truth is that we think we can control ourselves, but as the people at Alcoholics Anonymous know, you fake it till you make it. The way to change your mind is to change your behavior. The way to change your attitude on life is to pick the place that's going to influence you, the institution, whether it's the Marine Corps or college. And that's how we educate our emotions. That's how we change who we are, not by rational self-control and willpower the way we sometimes think.
David Brooks, my guest on WNYC, talking about his new book, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. We can take a couple of phone calls for David on these themes, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And as you often do in your columns, you're trying to tell us that we put too much stock in making policy based on the idea that people act rationally. Can you make policy based on the idea of reason and emotion commingling?
Yes, you need them both. And one of the frustrations is, you know, I've covered so many policy failures. You know, I covered the decline of the Soviet Union, and we sent in economists to give them hard currency plans. But what they really lacked was social trust, and we were sort of oblivious to that. Then I covered the debate over the war in Iraq. And we sent in the military, but we were oblivious to the emotional and psychological and cultural complexities of Iraq. So a lot of what this book does is show the things we think are soft and off on the periphery of politics are actually central.
Could we have sent in people to the former Soviet Union to develop social trust?
Well, there's certain things you can do to emphasize, and I'm not sure you can do it in another country, but one thing we could have placed a great more value on was having an honest judicial system, an honest police system, so people could trust the institutions. You know, it's harder, obviously, to go to a foreign culture and induce social trust, but in this country, we can do it. We can create, government can create places where community happens. And one of the things that this research, I think, shows you is the importance of face-to-face communication. There's an experiment done at the University of Michigan where they took a group of people, gave them a math test, and then gave them have them sit face-to-face with one another and gave them 10 minutes to solve the test. And the people who sat face-to-face solved the test. Then they gave other groups the same math problem, gave them 30 minutes, but they had to communicate by email. And those groups did not solve the problem. They generally fell apart. And the lesson is that face-to-face communication is just a lot more effective and a lot more powerful than email communication. And so creating density, creating places where people can meet face-to-face is actually kind of important.
Does that argue against the growth of long-distance learning via computer, or does Skype count as face-to-face?
Yeah, no, Skype does not count. Most of the signals we send are so subtle that we barely even notice it consciously, and that's why face-to-face communication is so powerful. And so, you know, with the computer in the classroom, I think computers can transmit knowledge as long as there's a teacher right there who's coaching and providing the emotional, intellectual, and other support that students need. But you pretty much, I think, we'd be foolish to get away from a model in which teachers and students are in a room together.
Sheila in White Plains, you're on WNYC with David Brooks. Hi, Sheila.
Hello, it's very nice to talk to you. I love your show.
Thank you.
And I love David Brooks, by the way, too.
Thank you.
What's your question?
My question is, I was an evaluator in a Bronx high school for 20 years and a teacher before that for almost 20 years, and I've become quite interested in dyslexia. And my question to you is, I saw so many kids in high school who couldn't read and who weren't able to do the work. That's why they dropped out. I don't think that the kids who are dropping out are the kids who are functioning well, who are doing well academically. I think the kids who are dropping out are the kids who can't make it in the school.
Sheila, I'm going to leave it there. David?
Well, you know, one of there are many factors that contribute to dropouts. One is, when you go into the classroom, say in kindergarten, do you know how to establish relationships with teachers? Do you know how to learn from other adults? The second thing is, do you have the ability to control your impulses? If you don't have those things, no matter what the teacher puts in front of you, it's going to be hard for you to sit still and learn that stuff. And then the final, you know, one question I have, and these are all undergirding academic achievement, it's not a replacement for it, but one thing you can do if you go into a classroom and ask kids, who's your favorite teacher? If somebody gives you the name of a favorite teacher, they'll probably graduate from high school. If they look at you like the question is bizarre because they would never have a favorite teacher, then they're in danger of dropping out. Mm-hmm. So I would say the social relationships are the basis of the academic accomplishment.
Jason in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jason.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me. Just a question to Mr. Brooks. David, I really applaud your book in bringing attention to the importance of attachment in kids' lives. I'm a psychologist, and what we tend to see is in poverty samples, there tends to be about a 50% rate of disorganized attachment among kids in poverty. We also know that socioeconomic status significantly impacts the quality of a child's relationship with their caregiver. And so I wonder what implications that may have for policy, particularly coming from a conservative angle. From a liberal angle, it seems to make sense that we would want policies that work with families in poverty to change these structural situations that seem to give rise to insecure attachment status and later problems in living. That it's, you know, your argument seems to imply that there actually isn't this focus on individual responsibility is somewhat misguided. In that it really is the milieu within which a child grows that creates the possibilities for either good or negative outcomes.
Jason, thank you. David?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would say in the course of researching this and spending these 5 years or so with people in this field, I've become much more, we still have individual responsibility, but I've become much more aware of context in triggering who we are. And as for poverty, it's a tremendously complicated interweave of both economic and cultural things. And so it's true that if you look at kids who grow up with a lot of economic stress, they react differently, they perceive fear differently, the stress has a measure impact on how they think. And so you have to relieve the economic stress. You also have to relieve the cultural disorganization, and I think things like the nurse family partnerships, where they send nurses in to coach single moms on how they can relieve some of their stress and how they can be better moms, that stuff also works. So one of the real challenges here is a lot of the disorganized homes, do we really feel comfortable sending in government agencies to try to reorganize homes? That's a pretty intrusive and paternalistic thing.
Absolutely.
But if we don't do it, then maybe we're just going to see a cycle of poverty repeated generation upon generation. It's a very tough problem, and I guess I've swung a little by the research in the direction of intrusive paternalism.
Hmm. I'm curious where you think Mayor Bloomberg fits in as an education reformer in the context of your thesis.
Well, I think one of the most hopeful things that's happened in education, and I'm generally pessimistic about government overall, but education has finally begun to focus on the core issue, which is the relationship between the teacher and the student. And now, with all the budget cuts in New York and across the country, the danger is that we're going to be getting rid of some of the younger and better teachers. I mean, there are good teachers up and down the age scale, but we're going to getting rid of good teachers just because they happen to be young, because they were the last ones to get hired and they're the first ones to get fired. And so we really should pay much more attention to that emotional ability or the ability to connect with kids and not just how long have you worked in the classroom. And that's a real risk right now.
Jonathan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with David Brooks. Hello.
Hi. Actually, I wanted to build on the last questioner's comment and David's response about this paternalistic bureaucracy, as you call it. It seems to me that that you're saying you're swung gently by the research, but it would seem that rather than calling on cuts for teachers, we should be, and you, as someone who's now an expert in this field, should be calling out for like a millionaire's tax so that these cuts aren't even necessary, right? I mean, there is another way. It's not a conservative way, but there is another way to preserve the relationships we have now without, running into cuts for teachers. So I'm reading you and hearing that you're swayed, but are you truly swayed all the way around to advocate for more taxes?
Well, yes. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the size of our fiscal situation, there are going to have to be cuts and there are going to have to be tax increases. I've probably written that in the New York Times 8 million times. And my fear is that I've met with a lot of early childhood people, foreign aid people, all these people with these great programs, and they're afraid they're going to get chopped. But right now, in our current budget situation, the merits of those individual programs are immaterial. We simply have this gigantic swallowing machine of basically entitlement spending and tax cuts, and those machines which are sucking up revenue and are forcing everything else to get cut. And so education, early childhood, foreign aid, all this stuff is just going to get cut regardless of the merits. And so I'm hoping that people in these fields, in poverty and family and education policymaking, will rally together and say, we really have to cut basically affluent seniors. We have to tax the affluent elderly and cut their benefits a bit in order to redirect money more toward the struggling young.
About neuroscience, David, you write that it helps fill the hole left by the atrophy of theology and philosophy. In a country as religious as ours, in what way do you think theology has atrophied in a way that leaves it incapable of dealing with these issues?
Well, you know, Henry Steele Commager, the historian, had a great phrase about the 19th century. He said in the 19th century, religion prospered while theology slowly went bankrupt. And I think we tend to be a religious country, but I'm not sure we're theological. And meaning, is there a firm doctrine? Do even people who are believers have a firm doctrine? And one of the things this research does for me, oddly, is that it helps me, at least, get reminded of what human beings are like, what human nature is like. And I don't think philosophers or theologians have done a great job of reminding us who we are. And more specifically, we tend to be children of the French Enlightenment, believing that reason is the most trustworthy capacity. But there was another Enlightenment called the British or Scottish Enlightenment that said reason is weak, but the emotions or the sentiments are sometimes trustworthy and sometimes strong, and we should honor them. And so we've had a bias in our culture which has encouraged us to overvalue reason and to undervalue emotion. And then we've had this sense that we're divided, that sort of like a seesaw, that if reason is up and emotion, then emotion must be down and vice versa. That's not true. Smart emotion leads to smart reason.
We have literally 15 seconds, but do you think it's hard for the educated people who tend to be in positions of power to get this because of their personal experiences?
Yes, I think we all are sort of emotionally constipated, at least in the policymaking world.
David Brooks, New York Times columnist. His new book is called The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. David, thank you very much.
Thanks much.
Brian Lehrer in WNYC, and as the first waves from a tsunami caused by the Japanese earthquake reach the United States, we will bring you the latest on the news coming up next. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC, an hour yet to come of The Brian Lehrer Show.